Sounds like I'm crackling here. Not quite sure why. I stopped. James, if you could just put the reading up, please. Good evening to everybody on Facebook. We're going to read from John chapter 9, because it's quite a long chapter and my voice is still a bit variable, shall we say. I thought we could perhaps read round this chapter, so it's going to come up on the screen, and if we can read a few verses at a time, we can read the chapter. So would somebody like to start reading John chapter 9?
As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?"
"Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work.
While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." After saying this, he spat on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. "Go," he told him, "wash in the pool of Siloam." This word means sent.
So the man went and washed and came home seeing. His neighbours and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, "Isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg?" Some claimed that he was. Others said, "No, he only looks like him." But he himself insisted, "I am the man." "How then were your eyes opened?" they asked. He replied, "The man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see." "Where is this man?" they asked him. "I don't know," he said.
They brought to the Pharisees the man who had been blind. Now the day on which Jesus had made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Therefore the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. "He put mud on my eyes," the man replied, "and I washed, and now I see." One of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath."
But others asked, "How can a sinner perform such signs?" So they were divided. Then they turned again to the blind man. "What have you to say about him? It was your eyes he opened." The man replied, "He is a prophet." They still did not believe that he'd been blind and had received his sight until they sent for the man's parents. "Is this your son?" they asked. "Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it that now he can see?" "We know he is our son," the parents answered, "and we know he was born blind. But how he can see now, or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him. He is of age, he will speak for himself." His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders, who already had decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. That was why his parents said, "He is of age, ask him."
Then they asked him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered, "I have told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it? Again, do you want to become his disciples too?" Then they hurled insults at him and said, "You are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from."
The man answered, "Now that is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly person who does his will. Nobody's ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing."
He said, "Do you believe tell me so that I may believe in him. Jesus said, you have now seen him. In fact, he's the one speaking with you. Then the man said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. Jesus said, for judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and all who see will become blind.
Some Pharisees who were with him heard him say this, and asked, what, are we blind too? Jesus said, if you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains.
Thank you very much. We're looking at how Jesus continued to do the miraculous, often through very mundane means. And this is the sixth of the seven signs that John records for us in his gospel. You know, throughout his life and ministry, Jesus healed many blind people. Matthew gives us details of him healing two blind men in Matthew chapter 9. And later in that gospel, we're told that great crowds came to him, bringing the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others, and laid them at his feet, and he healed them. Dave preached from that verse this morning, Matthew 15, verse 30. Mark tells us about Jesus healing a blind man at Bethsaida, and he also tells us about the healing of a blind man called Bartimaeus. Luke tells us that Jesus gave sight to many who were blind, and he focuses on the healing of a blind beggar when Jesus was on his way to Jericho. So these miracles were evidence that Jesus was the Messiah, because when John the Baptist sent his disciples to confirm the identity of Jesus, Jesus said, go back and report to John what you've seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor. But as so often, it's John's gospel that has a more detailed account. And this account of Jesus healing this blind man, we're given insights into spiritual connections that these healings also signify. You know, this healing takes up all of chapter 9. We see how what Jesus did was so much more than just improve the sight of one man, you know, the quality of life for him. He shows us how this healing involves the age-old question of sin and suffering, how physical healing isn't enough if we don't learn to follow Jesus, and what happens in the natural world also has spiritual applications. At the end, we see, you know, that even if we're not physically blind, we can be spiritually blind. So the miracle opens the door to conversations that are far more wide-reaching than just one act of healing. The chapter starts with Jesus and his disciples encountering a man who was born blind. And that prompts the disciples to ask the question, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And that question reflects our deep-seated belief that something's gone wrong with the world. It's not how it was originally meant to be. We see suffering all around us, inexplicable suffering, innocent suffering. You know, children are born with disabilities, accidents happen on a daily basis, natural disasters such as the earthquake that we've seen in Turkey and Syria this week, you know, they all abound, and we struggle to make sense of the pain and the tragedy that we see every day. And the Bible teaches us that God made a good and perfect world. That Genesis account of creation highlights that everything God made was good. But then it goes on to teach us that sin came into the world through man's disobedience to God. And as a result, separation from God, suffering, pain, and death all entered the world. The biblical account gives meaning to the suffering that we see all around. It connects sin to suffering, yes. But the problem comes when we automatically assume that personal suffering must be related to personal sin. It can be true. You know, there are consequences built into our world. Much suffering is indeed connected to our personal behaviour. You know, if we consistently eat unhealthily and greedily, our bodies will suffer the consequences. If we insist on putting harmful products into our bodies, such as too much alcohol, tobacco, drugs, we shouldn't be surprised if our bodies suffer as a result. But this chapter shows us we can't automatically assume that personal suffering is connected to personal sin. A baby born blind surely can't have sinned. So the disciples think, well, is this some kind of punishment then for the parents' sin? And they ask Jesus to explain the connections because they're puzzled about the complexities and mysteries of life just as we are. But Jesus firmly refutes any notion that personal suffering has to be connected to personal sin because he says, neither this man nor his parents sinned. He ends that debate with finality. We might find it easier to blame people for their suffering. We might find it easier, less troublesome, to make that definite connection. But that's not the Jesus way. Life isn't as simple as we'd sometimes like it to be. And Jesus goes on to say that this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. Now, if I'd been the blind man, I'm not sure that that answer would have particularly made me happy. You know, years of suffering and disability, just so a miracle can be seen. But the Bible teaches us that our lives have got purpose, that God has got plans for us. Those plans are good plans. And it can be hard for us to accept that teaching when suffering rears its head, especially long-term suffering. But this account reminds us again that God can bring good out of suffering. Miracles occur when we least expect them. God is able to do great things in our lives. We would prefer a pain-free life. We would prefer a life that's devoid of sorrow and suffering, a life where bad things only happen to bad people. But that's not the life that we live on earth. God's blessings coexist alongside battles. Miracles do happen, but they're not the be-all and end-all of a life on faith. Coming to terms with the fact that God's plans and purposes sometimes involve a very narrow road, including grief and suffering, isn't easy. But having dealt with this question of suffering in a way which perhaps gives us as many questions as answers, Jesus acted to help the blind man. Verses 6 to 7 say, after saying this, he spit on the ground, he made some mud with the saliva, and he put it on the man's eyes. Go, he said, wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. And so the man went and washed and came home seeing. And it's a miracle, isn't it, that uses ordinary things, spit, mud, saliva. But it results in extraordinary things, sight restored. You know, Jesus was never averse to using what was readily available to him, whether that was the young boy's lunch or the natural things all around him, because he knew that it was the power of God that actually brought the healing. It wasn't some magical item. Doing the works of God, works that by their very definition go beyond our natural abilities and power, means relying on God alone. And Jesus works with no fuss, no magical incantations. He doesn't even pray at this point. He just tells the man to go and wash in this pool, and on returning, the man finds that he can now see. Now, if John ended the story there, we'd still have a lot of things to think about. But he doesn't end the story there. And I'm glad about that, because this is one of the rare occasions when we get to see the consequences of a miracle. You know, a miracle might be the end of one story, the man's blindness, but it's actually the start of another, the man's life now that he can see. Yes. And that life involves testimony, repeated witness about what's happened to him, you know, because others can see that he's no longer begging and they can't quite believe their own eyes. And he confirms, yes, he was, you know, he is that man that was begging. And so they ask what has happened. And the man says, well, the man they called Jesus made some mud, put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see. You know, he just tells them what's happened. No embellishment. He just tells his story, and that's all we're asked to do. You know, others may ask us why we come to church, why we believe in God, why we've changed. This life of faith is all about giving testimony to what Jesus has done in our lives. And that testimony will continue throughout our lives because, you know, they don't quite believe what they're seeing and hearing. So the people bring this man to the Pharisees, to the religious leaders. And they also ask this, you know, what about this man who's healed on the Sabbath? And the man's answer is still clear and succinct. He put mud on my eyes, the man replied, and I washed, and now I see. He doesn't know where Jesus is now. He doesn't really know who Jesus is. He just says he's the prophet. But he knows the radical difference between being blind and being able to see. And we might not have all the answers to people's questions, but if we've got a personal experience of Jesus, we can talk about that. You know, our testimony might not seem as dramatic as this man's or Saul's on the road to Damascus, but it's a testimony nonetheless. Our personal stories have great power in demonstrating to other people that God is real and he loves us. You know, this debate rages on. The Pharisees question the man's parents. They don't really want to get involved in case they get into trouble. And so a second time, they summon the man and they ask him to tell the truth. We know this man is a sinner, they say. You know, they're so focused on the fact that this miracle happened on the Sabbath that they can't even focus on the miraculous nature of what's happened. And once again, the man is just reduced to telling his testimony. I was blind, but now I see. And the aftermath of this miracle shows us that not everybody was happy about it. The religious leaders, they were deeply unhappy about what Jesus was doing. They called him a sinner. They weren't rejoicing with the man in his healing. They were happier to believe that his blindness was a sign of sin. They said to him, "You were steeped in sin at birth." But the man finds that not only can he see physically, he's now got some insight into spiritual truth too. He says, "Well, we know that God doesn't listen to sinners. He listens to the godly person who does his will. Nobody's ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." You know, our testimony may not convince everyone, and it may even provoke hostility, even persecution from others. But we'll find that as we ponder on what God's done and what God is like, our eyes will be open to spiritual truth. You know, the religious leaders were angry with this man because he'd got spiritual insight. They didn't like the fact that they couldn't refute his words. You know, miracles can make people uncomfortable because we can't explain them. We live in a world where we like everything neatly boxed up and packaged. Yeah, we don't like to live with mystery. We don't like to live with answers that we only partially understand. We don't like to be confronted by events that we can't explain. That's why so many people try to explain away miracles as coincidences, or they come up with rational reasons that actually fail to satisfy. But ultimately, when our God steps into the world with a miracle, there will always be those who are threatened by his power and mystified by his grace and love and mercy. Our responsibility is simply to tell the story of what God's done. Our lives in Christ are a story that others need to hear. Paul says that we are living letters that other people can read. But John doesn't end the story there either. He goes on to describe a second meeting between Jesus and the man. It seems this time Jesus is deliberately seeking him out to ask him this question: "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" Because it's clear that Jesus wants more than just a testimony about healing. He wants this man to become a believer. Believing in Jesus is the key response that he wants to elicit in people through miracles. Now, the man answers honestly. He doesn't know who the Son of Man is, but he wants to believe. And Jesus introduces himself as the Son of Man. The man believes and worships him. He knows what Jesus has done for him. There's a recognition that this couldn't have just been done by a man on his own. So he says in verse 38, "Lord, I believe." He's moved from that simple testimony of what Jesus has done for him to a recognition of who Jesus is. And that's the journey that Jesus wants each of us to make, to move away from a selfish need for God to do the miraculous for us to an appreciation of who God is and for us to worship him alone. Are we moving on in our journey with God? Are we growing up? Children need their parents to do everything for them initially. They're selfish creatures. They can't exist without the help of their parents or some responsible adult. But as they grow, not only do they learn to do things themselves, they learn to see their parents as people, not just the source of food or clothing or help or toys. Are we learning to love God for who he is and not just for what he does? All ultimately, the punchline in this story comes when Jesus says that he's come into the world for judgment so that the blind will see and those who see will become blind. Now, the Pharisees instantly realize that he's not simply talking about natural blindness. They say, "What? Are we blind too?" You can feel the bristling, can't you, in their tone almost. They feel morally superior to everyone, and they hate having to learn from Jesus. But Jesus says if they're claiming to be able to see, their refusal to believe is a serious matter. If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains. You know, the miracle that Jesus has just done points to who he is, that he's the Son of Man, that he's come to save the world. But the Pharisees can only see someone who has healed on the Sabbath, and that to them is wrong. They've got very fixed views. They're not open to seeing that God sometimes works in ways that we can't explain or we don't even like. They're not willing to change. They're inflexible, bigoted, judgmental. And as a result, they won't be able to claim ignorance as an excuse. Instead, they're stubbornly refusing to change. The blind man has been on this journey throughout the chapter, a journey from blindness to sight. But his spiritual journey has gone even further. Now he believes in Jesus as the Son of Man. Now he worships him as Lord. And the Pharisees might be able to see physically, but their spiritual vision seems to be diminishing day by day because they're refusing to believe on the evidence of the works that Jesus is doing. At the start of the chapter, Jesus said, you know, that he is the light of the world. Light dispels darkness, whether that's literal or symbolic darkness. We need the light of the world to shine in our lives so that darkness is dispelled. We need to have spiritual vision so that we can see what's truly important in life. The choice is simple. There's two kinds of people, those who are blind and those who can see. But, you know, this situation is far beyond our physical state. It's our spiritual position. Are we believing in Jesus or are we rejecting him? You know, Jesus made it plain there's only two choices. Whoever believes in the Son has eternal life, but whoever rejects the Son will not see life, for God's wrath remains on them. We like to make things more complicated than that. But the metaphor of light and darkness shows us that we've got to be in one camp or the other. We either see who Jesus is, believe in him and worship him like the man, or we reject him because we don't understand or we don't like what we see, like the Pharisees and religious leaders did. So this sixth sign that Jesus does goes far beyond just the amazing miracle of restoring sight to a blind man. It's a sign to us all that we need the light of Christ in our lives. It's a reminder that we've got to see beyond the simplistic ideas that the world has about God, about sin, about suffering and judgment. We've got to grow in our understanding of who Jesus is. We've got to be bold in our testimony about him. And above all, we've got to understand that God works in strange ways. There's nothing glamorous, after all, is there, about spit and mud and saliva, but he works to bring glory to himself. And if we can understand that God's glory is what life is really all about, it's not about our satisfaction, it's not about our happiness or our personal favour, then we grow in faith, and then we grow in spiritual vision, just like this man did. Then our lives can be changed. We've got purpose, we can live under God's blessing. We can see then what life's really all about. And we will have the opportunity, like this man, to see the miraculous in the everyday happenings of our ordinary lives. Then we can enter into eternal life and we can move forward with hope and with boldness.